Today on The Conversation, I'm speaking to psychologist Nicole LaPera. Nicole is otherwise known as the holistic psychologist. She is, I would say, an internet sensation and is in many ways quite a controversial figure. She has written a new book called How to Be the Love You Seek, which I'm very curious to find out what that means. So please enjoy this conversation. Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
Where are you? What city are you in?
I am in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, wow. I thought you lived in LA.
I did for a brief 2-year period.
Uh-huh. Why'd you move?
I moved from the East Coast to LA for those 2 years. California wasn't going to be home base.
I see.
I was there when COVID happened, so it was a very unique California experience. So I expedited my departure, put it that way.
Right, right. Okay, got it.
I had about a 5-year plan that then got shortened until 2 years.
So now you're in Arizona.
Yes, I love it here. I'm looking to settle down finally for the first time in 40 years.
Wow, that must be interesting. What prompted that? The settling.
I mean, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, very much an urban environment, and I loved everything about a city. Growing up in the Northeast, I found myself priced out of apartments very quickly. So even if I was in the same city, I spent 10 years in New York, for instance. So I moved pretty much every year to a different apartment within New York City.
Yeah.
So the moving, and then obviously I left New York City for Philadelphia, then LA, and then here. I was moving to some extent because I was unsettled. And so finding the alignment in this climate and again, individually being at a place in my own journey where I'm like, yeah, I see value in roots.
I completely relate to that. And I feel the same way when I'm in New York City. I can handle about 2 to 3 days and then I'm desperate to get out into nature and just to kind of feel the space and the calmness of the energy. It's jarring to my system to be in a city like that for too long. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I want to start with this new book that you have, How to Be the Love You Seek. And it's really interesting because on the inside cover, it says, for decades, leading relationship advice has maintained that successful relationships require a specific compromise, that we must change our authentic expression to better meet the needs of others and vice versa. It may sound reasonable in theory, but as Dr. Nicole LaPera explains, this approach is nothing less than a recipe for a lifetime of resentment. I read that and I thought, yeah, that dispels practically every relationship advice book out there. And it's something that I've thought a lot about lately as someone who is in a long-term marriage. I'm 22 years with the same person. And I've been thinking, dear God, what happened to being yourself? Because we have to bring a version of ourselves to our relationships, to our work, to our kids, to our friends. It's always this edited version that is required for meeting other people's needs so that they can have the optimal experience of you. And at this stage of the game, when I read that, I was like, thank you, because this is exactly what I've been talking about, that in making all these compromises and editing who you are, you can find yourself going, I don't know what's left of me here.
And for a lot of us, that pattern of compromising, as you're beautifully putting it, Amanda, has been the lifetime pattern that we've lived. It's even become, for a lot of us, the identity, who we truly believe ourselves to be, these masks, these roles that, again, we've learned to play out of survival, out of the healthiest adaptation that we could have made very early on at a time where we were completely dependent on another human being to care for our wants and our needs. So we were in observation and attunement with the world around us. And some of us got very direct messages on the ways in which we had to change ourselves. And for others, much like myself, it was a little bit more indirect. Certain things were rewarded. Certain things weren't necessarily shame, but there was a disconnection when I would express certain aspects of my being. And before long, those were the instructions. So really simply, how in those relationships upon which we were dependent, we needed to adapt or modify, or the things that we had to show more or show less of. Of course, I'm really simplifying it. became for so many of us, not only our relational patterns, though for a lot of us, as I call them in the book, conditioned selves, our identity in our relationship. And again, developed at a time where we needed to adapt to survive, we continue to hold on to the belief that we do need to, that there is something intrinsically unworthy about how we are naturally. So we continue then to modify ourselves, which is why I think the large majority of us find ourselves either trying to find and unable to create or maintain a relationship, or maybe in a relationship, but not necessarily feeling connected, feeling fulfilled, feeling supported. And I think that is, again, because we continue to rely on these subconscious habits that at one time were adaptive, though no longer are.
And that raises a bigger question. And it's something I, again, have been thinking about a lot lately. We have the understanding that if we do not experience unconditional love with our primary caregivers, that we are consistently looking for that because we're looking to be accepted. As a parent, you have to let your child know that there are some behaviors that they have which are unacceptable. Does the child internalize that as there is something wrong with me? I think so. I think even if you say, I love you, it is this behavior that is unacceptable. I don't think that is a sophisticated concept. And I think that a child cannot internalize that in the way it's intended, and they end up feeling unworthy, not accepted, and unloved.
Yeah. And I think there is something to explore around what behaviors are being termed or deemed unacceptable, right? Because that's where things get really subjective for a lot, right? It maybe is outside of these moments, like you're saying, where there is some active explosive behavior that is causing direct impact. A lot of us have heard a lot of messages around certain things that are unacceptable that aren't
right, that are just
clear,
part of being a kid or growing
clearer,
up.
Right. So the meaning of what has become unacceptable is being applied, right, based on typically a belief, a framework, and the parents more often conditioning of what they have learned, sometimes even from a very well-intentioned place, right, is acceptable or unacceptable. And so I think that's where a lot of us have heard these messages outside of these moments where, yes, boundaries and limits, and that's part of the goal of a parent, or the role, the very astronomical role of a parent, is to create a safe environment or container in which a child can explore and gain confidence in terms of that exploration. So of course, there's some boundaries and limits that I think apply to this conversation, but I too have yet to meet the unicorn, as I call it, that has, for different reasons too, outside of this conversation around what's acceptable or not and the impact of conditioning. I mean, even the availability of resources that our parents or grandparents had access to or didn't have access to, the type of information that they were even being told in terms of parenting and what the goal is and what the job, right, and all of that. And all of then the systemic inequality, there's just so much, right, that is going to impact how a parent or caregiver, even with the best of intentions, shows up in those moments that then are going to continue to impact us into many more moments into the future.
So I think if we can accept as a baseline that all parents, to some degree, you know, fuck their kids up, right? Because it could be that they're working multiple jobs and they're not emotionally or physically available. If we accept that everybody is starting from this sort of deficit position, then what you're talking about is a kind of re-education of what is the behavior that we deem acceptable and unacceptable, but then also this education about a full self that's created. So ultimately, everyone has created a full self. I got into recovery at 22, so I've spent the majority of my adult life in recovery. The path back to self is never ending. And it really begs the question, can you ever really heal, or is it just ongoing?
I think too, and even going back to this concept before I answer that question, how are we defining self? Do we have the idea or expectation that self, who we're discovering, rediscovering, right, being in the world, is it a static or an unchanged? Can we define ourselves at one time and continue to define ourselves in that way?
No, it changes.
I am of the belief that it's not. It's an evolution.
It's fluid.
It's a fluid, right? So self, I think, is absolutely something that shifts, that changes, that we discover and evolve into over time. So as I'm on that process of discovery, then can I heal, right? How are we defining heal? Does heal mean in absence of upsetting emotions? Because I think some of us have that expectation. Once I'm healed, I am the Zen Buddha on the hill who never is upset by anything in life. Absolutely.
To me, that means that I return to center a lot faster. I reach for my tools with a faster turnaround. It's the impact is less and it's less frequent and less deep.
Yes, 100%. And then I return right to this home base of self, as we're defining it, which is an evolution, might shift and change energetically tomorrow, might feel different, perspective might change, might want to express something in a new way, right? This evolution, and I couldn't define it more similarly. What we're searching for, this definition, this objective marker, this destination endpoint, right? Where I can say, oh, I'm here now, I'm healed, and this is who I am, is not available in that way. In my opinion, it's the tools to return inward, like you're saying, after moments of dysregulation, which will be inevitably part of our human experience, and then returning back to that inner guidance, that intuition, right? That deeper compass that will give me then the directions forward, right? It will allow me to find my path to instinctually then determine what I want to express next, where I want to go next, what I need next. And again, I think that that comes from within. So when we create the space inside of ourselves, then we create the opportunity to meet ourselves and to gain that guidance that so many of us are looking for other people, right? In my opinion, again, doesn't come from any of those places. It comes from a continued connection to my deeper instincts. So we need that internal guidance from within.
It's interesting because you said years ago, I had an emotional breakdown followed by a spiritual awakening. I started questioning everything I thought I knew about life, everything I thought I knew as a practicing therapist. I found some teachers and new schools of thought I had never been introduced to within a clinical psychology program. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to you during that time frame and why what you were doing wasn't working for you?
There wasn't a thing that happened. It was kind of almost a gradual, as I like to describe it, descent. And the timeline of when it happened, now looking back, not so surprisingly, was just after I had completed all of my training, all of my licensure hours so that I was able to be licensed and open up a private practice. I had, within the years prior, moved from New York City, where I was doing all of my training, to Philadelphia, my hometown, if you will, where I was going to set up hypothetical private practice so that I could be accessible to my family that was also living in that area. I had moved from New York to Philadelphia with the person to whom I was married at the time. So I was in a committed, successful relationship, right?
Were you married to a man or a woman?
I was married to a woman at that time. Mm-hmm. We had been together for several years before we got married, but we made the move from New York to Philadelphia at the time together. As far as I was concerned, on this endless search for achievement that I had been on since I was very little, because it became very clear to me in my home and my relationship with my mom in particular, that moments where I was succeeding, achieving, whether it was bringing home the A's on my report card or excelling athletically, those were the moments where my mom, who struggled herself with chronic illness, chronic pain in particular, where her attention was distracted elsewhere, like you offered earlier, unable to be attuned or connected to me. However, in those moments, she was able to be attentive in celebration. I felt valuable, validated, and worthy.
I know what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
And it was evident to me, and I would strategically, it's funny you say that, Amanda, my mom wanted to involve me and to try everything. She involved me in all the sports. Let's go see which one you like best. For me, it wasn't about which one I liked best. For me, it was about which one I was best at. Very shortly, I could tell I exceeded and excelled at softball in particular. My mom loved that I was the star pitcher, right? All of this attention on me. So before long, even if I liked basketball more, which I might have looking back at this point, I quit. Or if I start at something and I immediately wasn't good at it, I stopped. I never did it again. I quit because I could tell so quickly the things that I was good at. So endlessly seeking achievement, similarly doing so in my relationship, always trying to be without need, right? Before long, I thought I was seeking value. So at this time, right, I checked all of these boxes.
Yeah, checked all the boxes.
Thought I was going to feel, I should feel fantastic, right? I should feel fulfilled. I should feel connected to this partner that I have, that I'm married to. I'm by my family. And I felt the near complete opposite.
Mm.
And for me, it was really eye-opening. I felt really shameful. I shamed myself a lot because I, like society, was like, well, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You have no reason. Because at this point, I was working with clients who were homeless, were living in shelters, were just out of jail. What they were dealing with to me was real trauma, real stuff. And what's wrong with me? I'm just sad. What sent me into trying to do something about it was, not only did I feel disempowered and frustrated and unsure of what was going on personally, I was more or less going to just chalk it off of, okay, well, something's just wrong with me. I started to feel just as disempowered and helpless in a lot of ways, right alongside my clients. Mm. So now here I had individuals coming in, right, paying me. Our job together was for them to gain awareness, insight, and oftentimes relief from whatever brought them into my treatment room. And by this point, having had the practice for a couple of years, I had patients who had been seeing me for those couple of years, week after week. I wasn't getting reports of, oh, I'm starting to feel better. Oh, this tool is working. Oh, I'm changing. I'm breaking these habits.
Were you just using basic CBT?
I wasn't. So I learned CBT. That was the gold standard. One of the modalities that I learned in my program. I also learned interpersonal therapy in my graduate program. So I did my kind of outside training in psychoanalysis. I discovered the concept of mindfulness on my own journey, my own personal life in my 20s. So the way I was working, I would call it more integrative
with psychodynamic
conceptual awareness in terms of the insightful conversations that we would have in the rooms. What wasn't, though, being talked about at that time was really anything about the body, about the nervous system, regulation. We weren't really talking about somatic tools in terms of how to navigate our emotions.
Not in traditional psychotherapy.
I had none of that information.
No.
So from that very desperate place, I just thought, oh, okay, this is just who I am. So my own struggle in terms of, oh, I'm an anxious person. I can't get rid of my anxiety. And well, I had no reason to believe that it was possible to.
So we cannot transmit something we don't have. You can only give people the information you have that you see is applicable
exactly.
And that has worked for you. I've been in therapy since I've been 15 years old. And one of the things that I learned pretty early on was I would go interview my therapists. And I'd be like, no, tell me about you. I want to know about you. Because I know that everyone can talk a good talk, but I want to know that you're living it. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to help me because I am too smart with this stuff. I've been doing it for too long.
Did you have therapists that would answer? I'm asking because so many of us are taught
not to.
Never to answer.
I know. Well, I would not
question.
Work with those people. I had a therapist right. When I was 18 years old who was what I would be deemed as unethical. She treated people out of her house, which was fine, but she let me have access to her family, to her pets, to sitting at her kitchen table, to calling her whenever I needed to. And that's what I needed to trust her. And she was smart enough and compassionate enough to allow that, even though it would have been deemed unethical. And that was the first person that I really connected with because I saw that what she said to me came from her own life experience. Yes. If I hadn't have had that, mm-hmm. I'd be like, yeah, I don't trust you.
I really appreciate you speaking so honestly and sharing this lived experience, even going so far as to directly ask, because I truly believe that when we leave the humanity out of the room as a therapist or as a client of a therapist, it really takes away from the ability to build the relationship, the trust, the security, the relatability. I mean, it is through the relationship of therapy, those of us that have access and the means to access the helping professional that is aligned, hopefully, right? It is the relationship we now know verified by research that if we were to study all different factors that could contribute to what would be determined as a quote unquote successful treatment.
It's the emotional connection.
It's the connection. So it's the humanity. So I do think that the field coming from conceptually, I can somewhat understand this idea of not being a human in the room, right? It's for the client. The issue is what has been created and repeated in a relationship. So to remove the relatability in a relationship, I do think is doing a great, great disservice.
I mean, it's interesting because you are a trained therapist and there's a lot of personal information about you out in the world. And that must have been a conscious choice to do that. Because when I was researching you, your personal life came up. Like, you're in a polyamorous relationship. And I thought, wow, that must have been a big risk to make that information public. I was really grateful that you are so transparent about your life. Why did you make that information public? And what was important about you doing that?
So the decision to go public when I did on Instagram and then to include it a bit in this book, the Instagram piece now happened probably over a year ago, if not 2 years ago, when I went public, was in service of myself, to be honest, my own healing. Because what I began to notice, because the relationship was in existence. And so as I would speak on podcast, as myself and my partners, Jenna, would work together. We run the Self-Healer Circle, my membership together. So there's many occasions where we get together for community check-ins, and her and I, as I often do here, share aspects of our own journey and things we're struggling with. And what I was starting to notice—
people start to wonder in the Self-Healing Circle while you were like, oh, hey, babe.
It was, no, I wasn't doing that. That was the issue. I was monitoring myself. I was censoring.
Right. You were leaving a part of yourself.
I left a part. I was being inauthentic, right?
Yeah, which you cannot be in your healing circle.
I was like monitoring and censoring. And, oh, well, this example included her. Of course, I could never say loving sentiments like that. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't use her in examples. And I was starting to feel like it was taking my that censoring process was taking me out of my authentic flow and being of service and being able to be grounded and present and not censoring myself is something that for me individually was an ingrained pattern that I've really had to work on, because I had watered down and censored myself for so long for so many different reasons, whether it was personal reasons, whether it was professional reasons, things I was told I had to censor. So for me, I'm really clear how important it is to be in my authentic self-expression.
I think it's really important that for people listening to this, to be in your authentic self does not mean you just say every single thing that comes into your mind. There needs to be a consideration about who you're saying it to, the tone you're saying it, and the room you're in.
Yes. This doesn't mean just a free associative without, though I was wanting to say particular things, not even off the cusp, share certain aspects of maybe what I was learning or of my own journey and struggles. And I was choosing that. But yes, discretion, of course. What are we saying to whom? How are we saying it? I even believe that there are certain things that are maybe just for us or our closest circles, right? We don't have to all be open books and tell everyone everything. There's discretion, there's nuance, and we get to determine how much we share and with whom. When I'm sharing aspects of my journey, my goal is always to use myself as an example to hopefully be of service. Now, especially in this day and age, I then lose access to not only people, how they hear it, listen to it, and react to it. To some extent, there have been articles that I haven't been a part of that have just been written about certain pieces of information that I have shared. So it really is, once you do put something out there, especially if you're doing so publicly, to some extent, you then lose access to take it back.
The narrative is no longer yours. It's the same as when you put anything out in the world, it becomes other people's. But I was fascinated just about being in a throuple, because I was thinking, I can just about handle one person and their needs and their feelings. I definitely would not have the bandwidth for another person and all their needs. So how, and by the way, you're a busy woman. How do you have time to be in a relationship with two people?
It is two individuals with two unique dynamics, two needs in terms of time, energy, you know, emotionality. So there is a lot of it. I mean, just to add to the complicated nature of it, the three of us, we run this business together. We all do separate things within the business, but then there's the professional dynamic in addition to the personal. We live together. We work out of the same home. So it is just a constant awareness of where I am individually, where my needs are, how they factor in.
Yeah. Do all of your cycles sync up?
Sometimes, yes.
Wow, man. That's sometimes. Three people with PMS at the same
time. They're not now. They're a couple weeks apart, just enough breathing room. Day to day, hormonally, us being just in different vibrations energetically, different cycles, different creative cycles, what's happening in the business for different aspects. Just how do we hold space for everyone to be where they're at, but also to stay committed to building
and the relationship. Are you guys in therapy together?
No, not currently.
Wow. Interesting. And do you feel like because you are the therapist, does the power dynamic change or how does that work?
I mean, in this relationship, I'm human first because of all of my wounding, everything we've been talking about is so alive and present that there are many times where I lose access to the therapist hovering awareness who's calm and grounded. And I'm just the little girl. Who's feeling vulnerable, who's feeling insecure, who's feeling threatened, who wants love and doesn't know how to receive it. That's the person that my partners live with. And I think that's important because I think sometimes people see people like myself, people like you, imagine the relationship and think, oh, well, everything must just be calm and grounded all the time, right? Because all of this insight and awareness and no, I am a human in dynamics with other people.
Yeah, nothing will set off your issues more than parenting and being in intimate relationships. I came up with this idea for like a dating show where you matched people based on their issues. And I really love the idea, right? So you would have someone who you would not put two anxious attachment people together. You just would not, right? I've done that because I am that person. It's like a disaster. You just got to have someone in there who has a secure attachment. In your throuple, is there someone in there that has secure attachment?
We are all doing our individual work to create more moments of secure attachment than others. But it's interesting you say this because there are certain aspects of both Lally and Jenna that inherently are very challenging to me. Right. From as someone who, based on my childhood experience, really struggled with distance, whether it was physical distance, being in a separate room. I love to do things around other people, even if we're not doing the same thing. Emotional distance. Distance to me meant abandonment, meant rejection.
Oh, yeah,
childhood.
Totally.
So I happen to both Lally and Jenna. Jenna more so loves time alone, loves solitude. Loves to be on their own, feels fed and nourished by it. So structurally,
I'm married to someone like that too.
Such a challenge.
Yeah.
Such a challenge for me. It's something too interesting. So even not to say that what she's doing is bad or wrong, or I mean, solitude is great. It's nourishing. But in that state where she's replenishing and meeting her own need, right? I'm over here wondering what the problem is. Is she mad at me? Is there something going on? Another, I think, thing, because what triggers us or activates us in our relationship sometimes are helpful qualities, right? I can learn and am learning how to have more solitude. Similarly, something that used to bother me to some extent still somewhat does about Lally. Lally, from the moment I met her, is very direct. When she has a want or a need, she directly says it and more often than not goes and does it, actualizes. In those moments where she can directly tell me what she wants or what she needs, whether it's time away, whether it's to do this in this moment as opposed to that, whatever it is, I would find myself getting irritated, annoyed, even upset. How dare you know what you want, say it directly, and then do it, even if what she wanted didn't have any impact on me at all.
Wow. You must have capacity to hold a lot of space.
And again, I'm working on it. There are a lot of moments, Amanda, where I run out of capacity. I run out of resources.
I mean, how can you not? It's a lot.
It's a lot. And especially in the more recent, after having vulnerably poured everything into writing a book, putting a book out into the world, promoting a book, all very exciting opportunities that I'm completely grateful for, though, took a toll on me energetically, even just the sheer schedule, some weeks of how my podcasting day and, you know, waking up, not enough time to take care of myself physically in the mornings, led to me just going into work. And so before I know it, especially for the last several weeks, I've been feeling very under-resourced.
Yeah.
And when that happens, I lose capacity. I lose access to capacity. I find myself repeating old habits, saying and doing hurtful things I don't mean, disconnecting when I don't really want to, just being generally irritable and agitated, not staying calm and grounded, raising my voice when I'm upset, as opposed to just taking a couple deep breaths and staying grounded.
One of the things that I find so disingenuous is when people are just putting a very edited version of their vulnerability out in the world. And again, we don't owe everybody all of our story, right? We owe whatever we feel comfortable with. But if we're going to lead with vulnerability and I share aspects of my life that are messy with you, I can tell when people are just giving enough so that they look like they're human. But you know that there's no way they could have this big, giant life they've got going on without these pitfalls, because they are indeed human.
Yeah. And that's the thing too, you know, and even go back to this idea of capacity, right? You can do the work to create capacity, and then you have to maintain capacity.
And that takes time.
That takes time. You have to be connected to where your resources are, stay committed within your boundaries and in service of replenishing those resources, so that when the unforeseen stress happens or just moment of life and emotionality, right, that we can remain grounded. So anyone, that's why I'm always the first person when, you know, I hear people say, oh, you must be so calm and grounded, or oh, aren't you done healing? It's like, no, none of that. It is really kind of, can I stay so connected to myself that I can tell when I'm over capacity? Can I then empower myself to make the choices to return to capacity so that I can be in power to be a conscious participant in how I'm showing up? Because if we're not, our body and our nervous system already has that autopilot. It knows what to do. We will still exist beyond capacity, though what we'll be doing is probably all that those old reactive habits that many of us now want to avoid.
You've probably heard about probiotics and the importance of a healthy gut microbiome. Well, I've got some news for you. Over 15 years of research on the vaginal microbiome have revealed that our gut isn't the only part of our body that thrives on an optimal microbiome. For years, Seed has been my go-to for improving my family's gut health, so I'm excited that Seed has launched VSO1 Vaginal Symbiotic. Your period, exercise, diet, sex, this can all mess with your vaginal microbiome, making it sensitive to imbalances and unwanted, uncomfortable issues. And I don't need to tell you that there's nothing worse than feeling like something is off with your vagina. That's why I'm so into Seed's VSO1. It's the first vaginal probiotic suppository designed to nourish your vagina with the essential biome it needs to flourish. I've read the research and I've interviewed the scientist behind VSO1, and I've decided to give my vagina the attention she deserves. If you want to check it out, please go to seed.com/AmandaC and use 25 Amanda C for 25% off your first month supply of Seed. So, and I agree with you 100%. And it does beg the question of what it takes for me to do all those things. It is practically a full-time job. A friend of mine, Fariha Roizen, wrote a book called Who Is Wellness For? And it's such a great book because the wellness industry generates almost as much revenue as porn. That is how huge it is, right? And it takes so much time and effort and energy that I often think that it is only for people who are in a privileged position of being able to apply all of these tools. Time is the one ingredient that we need.
Yeah, I think often too about just society, really in general, and how disconnected to some extent we are from our ancestral roots of what human society, civilization looked like, how it began, right? Because it began in groups. One person didn't have to do all of it. There was a distribution of childcare responsibility, so one person didn't have to do all of it. There was a, in terms of geographic distance, a close proximity to your neighbors, so you felt more comforted, supported. You had access to them if you needed, whether it was something logistical or emotional. And now, look at how we live. We're isolated. We're separated. We're working a ridiculous amount of hours for very little pay to keep a roof over our head in cities that are so disconnected from our families. We have no access to any sort of resources. when I developed the Instagram account itself is really a space for me to begin to share not only these tools myself, right? After being taught I shouldn't in my own journey in this new way. And very quickly, there was universal resonance. There was a lot of people joining, hitting follow from around the world. And I became acutely aware of, outside of how we have it here in the States, and we have a lot of issues in terms of inaccessible resources and financial means and everything that prevents us from getting treatment. And outside of the States, it can be even worse.
Yes, definitely.
So making sure these conversations are being had, this information is out there, and also focusing on any way. And if I'm being honest, when I began my journey, I too was very limited in terms of financial resources. The only income that myself and Lolly had was what I was making in a private practice, which wasn't very much to be surviving on. So when her and I began this journey, we were looking for all of the ways to utilize free resources, whether it was working out at a playground instead of joining a gym, or anything that we could do that could be low cost. So anytime I'm sharing tools, that's always an emphasis on what can be accessible, even if there isn't necessarily anything available. And more so, I'm very aware, and even myself, I don't want to, whether or not I have the time, I don't want to be. People who camp out in the gym for an hour and this exercise takes that long and then this meditation practice. So I'm very aware of time in terms of how we can fit these small practices, because it's not the marathon that's going to create change. It's the consistency.
I'm very challenged by consistency.
One small choice, right? Breaking down the expectation that you go and start a new workout regimen that's an hour long. I started a program that had practices that were 10, 15 minutes long. And I just kept that as my intention. It might even be 5 minutes for some of you out there, because what is important is fitting it somewhere into your day. Maybe even building it on a habit or something you do every day anyway.
Yeah.
Because these, I agree that time is invaluable, and for a lot of us, not present. We don't have the money to pay for the resources, but can we find a small moment in our day to use a resource that, for some of us, it's even just the breath in our body to help us shift or change the way we're feeling in that moment? One of the reasons I created what is now the Self Healer Circle was to give an entry point for people at a low minimal cost. For those of us that don't have maybe the meeting outside or the community, or maybe we live in a place where it's not even safe, right? To be engaging with others around us. So for me, I know that there's so many complicated feelings that we have these days about technology and the internet and all of the things that could be problematic. I am just such a champion and proponent of all of the possible ways of connection, right? That can offer. Because for a lot of us, that is, and for a lot of the members of my Self Healers community, I hear, you know, on our live events each month, how looked forward to these events are because they don't have the supportive community. And for them, this has become the safe space, those several hours a month. So I will always shout out technology as a possible valuable piece for a lot of us, this virtual landscape where we can begin to explore and find some of these supports, whether it's the practical resources of many people now that are putting out aspects of their work free of charge or low cost, or whether it's the community of people.
Yeah. Technology, when it's used for good, is incredible. Thank God for it. You were talking about when you set up your Instagram account and so many people started following your work. I'm curious if you were surprised at how many people actually created some kind of backlash against you. Was that surprising to you? And why do you think that was?
Yes and no, in terms of was it surprising? So I was aware that some of the things that I was going to be saying and doing, wearing the title of clinical psychologist that I wore, might be challenging for some of the beliefs.
Whenever you challenge the status quo, people will come for you. It's just part of it.
So knowing that I was going to start talking about the body and the nervous system and all this stuff that, you know, I went to a very highly accredited program at the New School in New York. That wasn't even on the cutting edge, right? We did more than just the CBT model. We learned interpersonal therapy, yet none of that was included. So I had the instinct that what I was going to be sharing would be new information. Of course, not everyone. I'm not by any means trying to suggest that I'm the first person who start to work holistically as a therapist? Absolutely not. I met and connected with a lot of other therapists that were doing and had evolved their practice similarly. So, yeah. But I knew for the large majority of the field in general that what they would be hearing was new. In addition, of course, to, as we've been talking about, hearing about me as a person. And I understand the backlash as new things are challenging. They challenge all of our nervous systems because what we're hearing, the newness of it could be threatening. We might hear something that I'm sharing that is directly against, right, what we believe to be true. And then before we know it, we're reacting from that threatened place. Mm. So we're arguing, we're tearing down, we're criticizing, you know, we're doing all of those things out of protection. So that's how I generally understand new information and how it's typically received by all of us too, as individuals. Anytime we read something new, even if it's not challenging a system or a model of practice, it will challenge our own biology.
But that must have been a new experience for you. And having been on the receiving end of internet vitriol myself, I think it takes a certain kind of thick skin to be able to handle that. So gosh, I'm curious how you handled that, because that must not have been easy.
No, and I appreciate you. It was and continues to be the most destabilizing periods of time. Not only am I someone who individually is conditioned to, I don't want to disappoint people. I want to be liked. I want this to be integrated. I'm so excited. And it's changed my life and now the lives of many people, not only who have worked with me individually in the community, like, why aren't you as excited? It's just a challenging thing when negative feedback, even just outright misinterpretation. I mean, I've heard things reflected back that I've said in articles that were the farthest thing from anything I would ever say because I don't believe it to be true. Yeah. So me learning how to deal with all versions of feedback is still a really big learning. What I have been able to do and empower myself is noticing the role I play when feedback is happening. Because what I noticed when my body is dysregulated, whether because the feedback happened or something even unrelated to what's happening online is happening in my life, what I would notice that I personally would do, I would pick up my phone and go to agitating. I call them the detractors. I would go to the detractors pages and I would affirm my agitation.
Yeah.
I would amplify, if I spend enough time there, my agitation.
Yeah.
I was spending so much time thinking and obsessing about what other people were saying or engaging with it that I was never giving my body a chance
to calm down,
to become regulated
and then respond from that place. If indeed you decide to respond at all.
Exactly.
It's interesting because for famous people, this is just part of being famous, right? Is that you're going to get, you know, haters. And one thing we all know is do not read the comment section of the Daily Mail. Like, do not do it, because psychologists are not normally experiencing fame, which in turn invites this kind of attention. And so it must have just been very jarring.
In terms of even hearing you describe a famous person, there's a very frightened little girl inside that in her very young childhood was so painfully shy. She would hide behind her mom's leg while I desperately, as we all do, want to be seen and honored and valued and respected for who we are and what we think and what we have to share with the world. That little frightened girl is still inside.
Yeah.
Is so desperately vulnerable and fearful of being seen. So everything about the public, me sharing my perspectives that can go to a public audience, me hearing, receiving, or even knowing that there's public feedback out there is so fraught with that conflict still. As much as I want it and I can see the service that I'm able to provide, I hear the feedback near daily from people who are impacted by the service that I provide, yet that same fearful, vulnerable part is inside of me that's like, wait a minute, but don't really look at me, but don't really listen to what I have to say. So every aspect of the public nature of my life is still so deeply challenging that even in moments of something that I'm excited to do, oh, wow, look at this opportunity where I can serve this many people by being public, by giving a speech or being in this auditorium. There's then that little girl, but it's like, don't you want to just run away and cancel the event?
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I know that. I know that feeling really well. So one of the things that I did notice is that there was a specific group of people, women of color, who really did take issue with you. And I wanted to know why you thought that was.
So let me talk generally about feedback. Feedback in general, and I have gained such incredible, valuable insight of when receiving feedback, even against my willingness to receive it at first, not agreeing with it, from other people, because we are all so blinded. We can only know our lived experience from our lived experience.
So yeah, we all have unconscious bias that we're unaware of.
Exactly. So whether it's personally, and I just can't see aspects of my conditioning, or whether it's aspects of my identity that
sure.
have been validated
we
or
all
invalidated.
Have that.
So incredibly important. Most of the feedback I had determined was not beneficial. It doesn't mean that I don't take a moment to hear feedback. So when all feedback comes in terms of systemic issues, in terms of just belief modality issues, I did take a moment.
What was the main complaint?
There was an event, an interpretation, misinterpretation, stories that then evolved
sure.
from an experience. And, you know, again, for me, because my community is so international, so global, because accessibility and navigating these very real structural inequalities are part of our mission, really, you know, at the Holistic Psychologist, me and my whole team now, right? I heard and also, you know, kind of held space for differing perceptions, and also am really grounded in the reality of this, the resources, right? What I offer. So really complicated. I can't exactly say, you know, what it is that happened, that didn't happen. I do say that I hear every feedback that does happen. Sometimes I spend too much time with certain feedback than others. And I think it's just like, there's some aspects of online world, like I was saying, what happens then gets complicated by everything that can come from that.
Do you think, and I'm just wondering about timing. So your kind of exponential growth and awareness, to my mind, and correct me if I'm wrong, happened during lockdown, right? It happened during COVID when people were at home a lot more and were looking for help, quite frankly, which also coincided with the BLM movement really growing in inertia. When I think about the timing, that period of time was when so many people were for the first time becoming aware of their unconscious bias right. and their prejudice and their lack of inclusivity. It was an educating period of time for many, many, many people. Some people got singled out and were kind of collateral damage for the very needed global education. It's, you know, the same thing with the Me Too movement. There are people who were collateral damage in a movement that absolutely was needed, and the awareness was crucial, and thank God it happened. So when I think about timing for you, it feels like it was around that time. Is that accurate?
What was happening in terms of lockdown and COVID was what I would define quite universally as a trauma for all of us, right? So now
definitely.
We have this activating time for the large majority of us who are carrying core wounds from our childhood. And I can see why we had this kind of percolation that in many instances exploded or imploded in different ways around that time for different people. I will speak to the other side of it. While it was really destabilizing, really challenging, really did kind of regress me in a lot of ways by, you know, activating my core wounds included, the gift, if I can even call it that, of an experience like that, and this even kind of ties into the kind of censorship conversation I was having earlier internally, it has given me much more secure confidence in myself. Because not that people won't continue to interpret or misinterpret or whatever it is that I talk about or whatever it is that I do, but the trust and confidence that I'm developing and cultivating is in my ability to navigate it. In my ability from to know it's there and engage with it, right? In this moment of healthy ownership or responsibility and perspective shifting in the moments where it can be of service for all
sure.
of us. And also my ability to navigate it or interact with it by knowing not to interact with the reality that it's always there and always present. Because that thing that I was describing in those moments of agitation, I carry that for even years. Like, so things died down and nothing then was as alive as it was back in this 2020 time. Yet a year from that moment, say, when I was just feeling agitated and bothered by something, I would then go check back in. It wasn't just like in the vacuum of, oh, well, yes, of course I was looking because it was active. Oh no, this could have been well dead all intents and purposes, but I remember that it's there. So now when I'm agitated, so that's the trust and confidence that I'm describing. I can now know, and I imagine there might be things out there that I don't even know are there.
When you were talking about the trust and confidence in yourself, what I was thinking about was whatever part of you that was unconscious and was uneducated is now, it sounds like, conscious and educated as much as a white woman you can be. So the trust and confidence in yourself is, I now have that information, and my interaction, my dialogue, my care of that space is now different. So I can feel confident in my approach to it.
Yes, we integrate new information, new awareness, the gift of perspective that many times our romantic relationships or our closest relationships can begrudgingly offer us at first, right? All of that allows us to integrate our wisdom, to grow, to change, to evolve, to navigate the next moment in a slightly different, more grounded and responsible way, or at least in a conscious and intentional way, right? We are showing up, deciding what happens, as opposed to the existence that so many of us are living on that blind autopilot, where it naturally then does feel like life is happening and I don't have any control to create change.
One of the areas that I feel frustrated with is that people are not given the space to be able to change and evolve. And I don't mean personally, although that can happen too, I mean culturally. At the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the sense of self. And is that a one and done? No, it's a constantly evolving, fluid thing. And what you're talking about is a shift in perspective, an expansion and an integration. And that is the case for practically everybody. If you're willing to say, thanks for that education, didn't realize, now I do, appreciate it, thank you, I'm better for that in the long run, and let me integrate that into who I am. Culturally, people don't allow space for it. And I think it's a real problem because people are criticized for having a perspective. But even if they do expand that perspective, they're still criticized, as opposed to people saying, thanks, I appreciate it. Because at the end of the day, do we want to just criticize, or do we want people to grow?
I think we criticize, we struggle to allow space for growth or mutual evolution, or even space to be curious and understand another person's perspective when we are in survival mode, when our nervous system and our body does not allow us to expand or expand space and be curious about another person's perspective and allow growth and change and newness or stress to our nervous system. So much of that inability that many of us are currently operating within, in my opinion at least, is a remnant of the survival mode that many of us are still stuck in because of the intergenerational trauma, as the subtitle says, break cycles have been passed down. What I'm very hopeful about is seeing, and even conversations like we're having right now, all of the awakening that's happening and healing and incorporation of our bodies into conversations and healing, and even watching the field itself, psychology, become much more somatic or physical, body-based, trauma-informed, nervous system savvy, if you will. And I see a future where we will be able to remove the box that we're putting around people desperately trying to seek safety and predictability, unable to tolerate difference. And we are moving toward a collective that, in my opinion, can accept the uniqueness of people, can explore and be curious about the uniqueness of people, can hold space for differing perspectives, wants, and needs in any given moment, and can still work collaboratively together in harmony.
Oh my God, that's the dream. That's the dream.
Well, I'm holding the vision. So
That's the dream.
I'm here for it.
I want to just go back and talk a little bit about this book because I want to get some clarity on what you're talking about when you say we've adapted all these parts to be acceptable and to be in relationship. What's the alternative that you're offering?
What I'm offering is an opportunity to first become aware, see the parts that we've adapted, to unlearn those parts, for the opportunity to embrace our wholeness, to maybe rediscover our authenticity, and to create what I believe is truly safe and supportive relationships where we can all be ourselves, where there's room and space for all of us to be who we are in community, in partnership, in togetherness.
Wow, that sounds good too. I love what you're saying. And there's a part of me, I have to be honest, that feels like I don't know that that's possible. I mean, look, I live this every day, right? I am not giving up. I'm not giving up on it. But there is a part of me that just knowing how hard it is to heal, that I don't know. It's not going to be in your lifetime or my lifetime. But maybe we're planting really great seeds for future generations.
I know we are. When we change individually, do we change our relational and our environments by nature of the signals that we're sending out? So we're becoming that safe beacon, right? Sending out those signals of safety to those around us, possibly creating the opportunity for them to feel safer and more secure, right? To be themselves. So energetically, you know, we are impacting those in which we are in current relationship. I also know that from the science of epigenetics, that when we change and heal and rewire in the way that we're doing our mind and body, we are then changing the way our DNA expresses itself, which then has a direct physiological impact in any future generations that we might choose to create. So we are planting, in my opinion, Amanda, the seeds, the recipe, not only in just like woo-woo, this is a nice idea, in what I can point to is energetic science, epigenetic science, that this is the beginning of change. But I do want to honor what I imagine people are kind of shaking their heads at. Yeah, it is hard. There is a lot of commitment and change and new action. And for a lot of us, resilience that we have to teach our body or our nervous system. Though with that, and this is why I do still sit, hopefully, changes are being put in place that will have such a great impact, some of which we will be able to see in our lifetime or experience, and many of which that we will leave as our legacy.
Yeah, when you talk about epigenetics, there's a very clear differentiator that I've seen. I had my first child when I was 19 years old, and my unhealed abandonment wound was so fired up. I hadn't even put a dent in it at that point. And that child has that imprint. By the time I was 35 years old and I had twins, that wound, I had put a huge dent in it, right? Those kids do not have that imprint. They do have other imprints of wounds that I had not healed, but it was fascinating for me to see that.
It's such a breath of possibility, as I think the word, because what we had been taught, again, even in the medical institution, this is why I do have compassion for a lot of the suffering that is at hands of the medical institution, these old archaic beliefs, because that's not what we had been taught, what doctors had been taught. They really leaned into the science of solely genetics. Genetics determine everything. Environment does nothing, which really left us as humans completely powerless. Well, we just get what we're born with, and there's
get
no
what
possibility.
You don't get upset
to create change. And that's not the reality, thankfully, that we're living in.
Yeah, it's really not. And I just want to thank you for all of the tools that you're putting out and for making so many of these modalities accessible. Your Instagram posts are something that I point to when I give an example of how social media can have positive impact. The amount of people I know who have learned really practical, helpful, supportive tools from your social media alone, not to mention your books. There are so many of them. And I just want to thank you for continuing to put yourself out there and for being a lightning rod, because it is not an easy job. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all those very kind and supportive words that really, truly, they mean so much.
Thank you so much for listening to that fantastic episode. Please like, subscribe, and all that business. It does really help the podcast. And most importantly, come join me on Substack. Substack is where I'm showing the video of the entire episode that you just listened to. So find me on Substack if you want to dig in a bit deeper to the subjects that we talked about in this episode. See you there.